Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is August 5th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. It's hump day, so hang in there and stay with us because we got all kinds of stuff to tell you about today. Coming up, find out what's going to happen to all those lions, tigers, and monkeys that have been housed at the Wildlife Way Station in Sylmar now that it's all closed up. That's coming up in a few minutes. And what's going to happen to Men's Central Jail in downtown LA now that the County Board of Supervisors has decided against turning it into a mental health facility? More on that in about 20 minutes. But we start today with a look at LA Unified. The district is considering a plan to rate public schools as well as privately run charters. The program called the School Performance Framework could roll out as soon as October, rating schools on a scale of 1 to 5. The goal? Well, they say it'll give parents more choice, but there are, of course, concerns over how schools will be rated and what the system might mean for schools in areas with lower incomes. LAUSD board member Nick Melvoin helped propose the system. He's joining us now. Welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, the first question that comes to mind right off the bat on this is how a person could even start ranking a school. There are different criteria depending on the grade level, so break it down for us. How would it all work?
Well, I should mention that we're not doing this in a vacuum. There are these school rating systems out there, and our hypothesis and proposition is that they're not that good. You know, the biggest one that I know a lot of parents are familiar with is greatschools.org, and it looks mostly at test scores, an objective kind of one-shot-in-time test score. What we wanted to do, and we've been working on this for well over a year with our teachers and our parents and experts in the field, is create something that was holistic, multi-measured, looked at growth, you know, how are students doing over time at a school, and looked at demographic subgroup data and tried to get to a robust tool. We know there's not a perfect school performance framework. It's in some ways an art and not a science, but we wanted to make sure that we were providing parents with better information that they were getting with these other sites, and that we also were giving the board and district leaders as much data as possible to make sure we're continually improving.
But tell us, what would be a 4 or a 5? What would require a school to get that kind of score?
Well, I think, you know, and no surprise to parents, because I think a lot of this they see when they're out at school. So in our performance framework, which again was developed over the course of a year with a large stakeholder group, we're looking at growth. How are kids doing who start, you know, if they come to your school, are they leaving more prepared than when they got there? We're looking at school climate. Are kids happy there? Are adults happy there? Are parents satisfied there? We are looking at objective levels of achievement, because this is a district where only 3 out of 10 kids are doing math at grade level, and I, for one, don't believe that's acceptable. And so we want to make sure that we're pushing kids forward. But we're also looking at how do you do with a subgroup. If you're a school and you're only doing well with white children from a certain income level, well, that's not good enough. So we want to make sure that you're doing a lot to close performance gaps and opportunity gaps between different subgroups. So it's a holistic tool that's going to try to, from that, give us a whole plethora of information, but we know that we need to give parents something that's summative and easy to digest, because that's what they have out there already, it's less perfect.
Now, Nick, there are about 277 charter schools that are under LAUSD oversight. Would the rules apply to them in the exact same way?
They would, and that's one of the reasons that we did this as well. We want to put every school on an equal playing field. We want to make sure we're speaking with one vocabulary about all of our kids and kind of get away from this us versus them system.
We're talking to LAUSD board member Nick Melvoin, talking about a rating system possibly for the LA Unified School District on its schools. Now, when it comes to ranking schools based on test scores, it's well known that test scores are often linked to socioeconomic status. Could we end up with a system where the poorest public schools wind up with the lowest ratings, Nick?
Well, I hope not. And what we're really looking at with this system, and again, working with stakeholders and advocates and teachers, is something that looks at growth. I was a teacher in South Los Angeles. When I was teaching middle school, my students were reading at a second grade level. If I was judged on whether I got them to an eighth grade level, I'd find that unfair. But if I got them to a third grade level or a fourth grade level, then we show progress. And as a school, that's what we want to see. I think what we're going to see with this tool is that there are different schools with similarly situated students. Some are doing really well, some are struggling, and we want to figure out how to replicate high-performing schools and really how to support those schools that are struggling. That's what this is about compared to some of these efforts in the past. It's about continuous improvement, targeting our resources to those schools that need them most. Not to put any label on a school or to be punitive, but to say, we know, or I know, that all kids can succeed at high levels. If certain schools aren't achieving those outcomes, let's give them more support and figure out how to make sure every kid graduates college ready at LAUSD.
But when you say you hope not, that you hope that the poorest schools don't wind up with the lowest ratings, it sounds like the system could allow for that, though.
Well, I think that the system without this allows for that. We have systems where we're not directing resources to our high-need schools. We're not making sure our best teachers are there. We're not making sure our best principals are there. And as a result, students who need extra support aren't getting it. This school performance framework in some ways isn't going to, in that regard, tell us anything new. But I think it will let us speak with one vocabulary about schools that could do better than they're doing now. So, and like I said, I think we're going to see a lot of variation in schools in certain communities. And what I'm interested in is those outliers. Again, I believe every kid can succeed at high levels. Some schools are showing us that that's possible. Others are struggling. And I think we just can't hide from the truth here that we know that some schools are closing achievement gaps more quickly than others, and we need to replicate faster than we are.
But wouldn't this rating system maybe hand some advantages to charters and magnets, places where parents proactively choose to place their kids in?
Well, some magnets, are kind of self-selecting by design. We have highly gifted magnets, et cetera. And yes, and that's why another priority of mine has been increasing access and equity through our open enrollment platforms. These are all important conversations that we need to have. I think the biggest point is that we just have to have the conversations. There's not going to be a perfect tool here, but even this conversation about questions of access and equity are things that the district has run away from for too long. So if we are seeing that magnet schools are doing better, well, we should ask why. And if it's about how parents are self-selecting, why don't we do more to recruit parents who aren't selecting?
Well, aren't those schools, don't those schools have a stacked deck in a way against a school that isn't a charter school or a magnet school?
Well, then my question would be, why don't we have more magnet schools? You know, once we identify our high-performing schools, and that, again, is where this all started, which is that we don't have a way. If you ask me, what are the schools that are the fastest-growing middle schools in LA Unified? We don't have a tool to tell you that. So if they happen to be magnet schools, we'd want to say, well, then let's create more magnet schools. Or let's see who are in those magnet schools and make sure that we're opening them to all through some innovative, you know, maybe we keep seats at magnet schools for kids that don't select. And we go out and we recruit those kids to come to those high-performing schools. This is a conversation that's long overdue in a district where less than half of kids are graduating eligible for college. And I think this is one of many steps to try to get us closer to improving that.
That's LAUSD board member Nick Melvoin talking about his plan to rate public schools. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me again.
All right, moving on now to the animal kingdom. Hundreds of lions, tigers, chimpanzees, and other exotic animals that once had a safe haven in Southern California are now in need of a new home. The Wildlife Way Station in Sylmar is closing after fire and flood damage and also leadership changes that led to struggles with its upkeep. Now, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife is taking over and will be tasked with ensuring the animals are cared for and eventually relocated. Thing is, though, that will not be an easy job. Jordan Traverso is deputy director of the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and she told us more about the facility and all the animals there.
It started in 1976 as a wildlife refuge. There are about 470 animals there. There's 42 chimpanzees. There's bears. Some of them are grizzly bears. There's some domestic animals there as well. So not just exotic species, but also some donkeys and horses and things that are likely to be easier to place. The exotics are probably the ones that are going to be more difficult.
Yeah. I can imagine when a circus maybe couldn't use their animals anymore for the tricks and stunts that they would do, maybe that's when the Wildlife Way Station would get them.
I suppose it's possible. I actually don't really have history of how each one of the animals got there, but a lot of these animals that they've taken in were exotic animals imported into the state illegally that have been seized and then given to the way station. Others were used in films. It happens often that somebody will bring in an alligator or think that'd be a fun pet or a tiger, and then when they can't take care of them, they want to get rid of them, and that's why there are restricted species in California that people aren't allowed to have as pets. So the permit is actually through the Fish and Game Code 671, and it allows for the possession of restricted species, but we don't give them out for people to have pets. We give them out for things like wildlife refuges. There's a number of different reasons why we have them, but it's not to have pets.
Talking to Jordan Traverso, Deputy Director of the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Now, the weigh station is closing. When did it start to have problems, though, with its upkeep?
Well, there have been some problems. It's really an aging facility already, and they had some extensive damage from the Creek Fire in 2017. They also had some flooding that happened earlier this year, and they were just unable to get it up to what is required for the regulations currently. I understand there was also some change in leadership. One of the people who has been heading the organization stepped down. And there's a number of different regulations that you have to meet in order to keep your permit valid, and they were having difficulty doing that.
Had the Department of Fish and Wildlife been monitoring the problems at the weigh station before finding out its board of directors voted to close the place down?
We are, as part of the permitting for that 671 and Fish and Game Code for the restricted species permit, we do inspections from time to time, and there have been inspections in the past. We hadn't gone up there to check for violations specifically. They came to us and said, we're not capable of doing this. So last week, on the 11th, we got word that the board of directors had voted to surrender the facility's permit voluntarily. And they had decided to close the facility. So now it's closed to public. It's closed to media. Then that's indefinitely. We won't be allowing people to go up there and tour the facility. And my department, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, has gone in there to ensure that the transition to place the animals will happen quickly and smoothly.
All right. So you guys are in charge now. What are the next steps to make sure these animals are safe and find them a new home?
So that's the million-dollar question. That's a lot of animals to place, but we do have a network of national, international, local organizations that actually take in exotic animals. I personally have even been contacted by a number of them. There's an incident command structure that's set up there close to the site, and they're intaking calls, and people are asking, you know, saying, I have a permit and I can take three cats, or one of them was in Minnesota, one of them was in Washington, and they're saying they can take this many chimps, or I can take this many, you know, small primates or small mammals. All kinds of different help has been coming out of the woodwork, which is excellent, but we actually think it's probably going to be a pretty difficult process to get through placing all those animals, but we'll be there until it's complete.
What animals, Jordan, do you foresee as maybe being the tougher ones to try and find a home?
I think probably the ones that'll be the most difficult are going to be the chimpanzees. There's 42 chimpanzees. A number of them are already under some kind of medical treatment, or they're taking medication. A lot of them are geriatric already, and so they need special care. And in order to keep them accustomed to the care that they've been getting at Wildlife Weigh Station, it might take a little bit longer to find a place that can keep that level of care.
You mentioned how some of these animals, Jordan, might have a long way to go before they find their new home, maybe have to travel a long way. What's the process of moving some of these animals like?
Well, actually, that's part of the difficulty, too. There's special rules about how you have to transport the animals and what kind of enclosures you have to transport them, and it can be very stressful for the animals. I've seen some of the animal welfare organizations that we have been in contact with have said we also can transport. So they are willing to take a few animals, and they have the ability to transport them.
Could the weigh station maybe be repaired and stay open to house a smaller amount of animals?
Because they have surrendered their permit, these animals will not be at the weigh station anymore. They will be placed elsewhere. If they were to fix the situation at the facility, and that would take a lot of effort to get the facility up to code, and they would have to come back to the county and then to us in order to reapply for a permit. So it would have to be a whole new process.
You know, so many animal lovers that listen to KPCC, and this story has kind of really bummed them all out. How unusual is this case, though?
I think this is very unusual. I've been in this job for almost 12 years, and I have not seen a relinquishment of a permit like this, and especially in a facility this big. The good news, though, is that the animals are going to stay on site until they're placed in an appropriate facility, and they're going to be continuing, they're going to get continued care. So hopefully that will ease the minds of many of your listeners.
Well, that's good to hear. Jordan Traverso is Deputy Director of the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. She's been speaking with us about the Wildlife Way Station and Animal Sanctuary in Sylmar that's closing its doors. Jordan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I remember the pair of Ridgecrest quakes, 4th of July and then the day after. They were 125 miles away, but it shook the ground all over L.A. Not enough, though, to trigger the Shake Alert L.A. app. That's the one owned by the city. Angelenos were wondering why it did not alert them, some loudly so. Coming up, find out how the city of L.A. is shaking up its early warning app. That's next when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an info session to learn more. Classes start September 3rd. Apply by August 5th for up to $8,000 in scholarships at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. LA's earthquake early warning app has been updated. Now it's going to let people know when there is weaker shaking, not just a major earthquake. The change comes after Shake Alert LA users took to social media following two powerful earthquakes near Ridgecrest in early July that did not send notice. For more on how this system has changed, we have Bob DeGroot. He's a physical scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey, which is the brain behind the Shake Alert LA app. Bob, welcome to Take 2.
Good afternoon.
All right. Before we jump into the changes, so remind us how the app works exactly. It does not predict earthquakes, right? I think people need to make sure that they know that.
That's right. Yeah. So earthquake early warning works on the principle of detecting the earthquake once it reaches the surface. And the USGS is involved in detecting the earthquake, basically making a decision whether or not a shake alert should be issued. Then we would hand it over to the city of Los Angeles, in the case of the Shake Alert LA app, hand it over to the city so that they can deliver that shake alert.
Now, from the time the quake happens to the time ideally someone gets an alert, what's that time frame?
We want to make it as small a time frame as possible. In the case of the Ridgecrest earthquakes, we were able to generate those alerts within about 8 seconds.
8 seconds. Okay. Now, what's the reach of Shake Alert LA? I mean, how far away is it looking to detect earthquakes?
So Shake Alert LA is going to get messages from earthquakes that are potentially pretty far away. But the idea is that the only people who are going to get shake alerts delivered by Shake Alert LA will be Los Angeles County.
Los Angeles County. Okay. Now, the changes to the app lower the threshold of what is worthy of an alert. What criteria has changed exactly?
The basic criterion that's changed in this case is that rather than being alerted for earthquakes that may cause damage, potential damage, like something falling off of a shelf or someone getting hurt, it's been moved down to where people might just feel the shaking and know that an earthquake is happening.
So just knowing any kind of shaking is what we're talking about.
Basically, yes. So it's been lowered from light shaking to weak shaking. And there's, you know, that's sort of a hard thing to define, but basically just sort of a very sort of back and forth feeling that you feel when you feel a light earthquake. That's basically what the alerts would be, where they would be delivered to people in LA County.
Because I got to be honest, the thing is with this kind of alert, if I feel the quake and the alert doesn't go off, it makes me think that something's wrong.
That's right. And that seemed to be the feedback from a lot of the folks through social media and through email and that sort of thing. And so we've heard what the folks are saying, and we worked with the city of Los Angeles to allow them to lower the threshold for delivery of the shake alerts.
So other than peace of mind, Bob, what are the other benefits of a lower threshold? Would it give us more time to respond?
Potentially there would be more time available to respond, yes, absolutely. And you could get to a safe place to take a protective action such as drop cover and hold on. And just the awareness that these events happen, and you can continue to think about what would I do if I were in this location and an earthquake were to happen.
Talking to Bob DeGroot with the U.S. Geological Survey, talking to us about updates to the Shake Alert LA app. Now, obviously, no system is without errors. And now that the threshold has been altered, do you expect the data to be maybe less accurate?
So the whole idea behind delivering shake alerts at lower thresholds, there is the possible chance where you may get an alert, but you may not feel anything. The really weak shaking, some people feel it, some people don't. So people are going to wonder, why did I get an alert and I didn't feel anything? And so that's going to be a question that we're going to have to answer.
Is it better, though, to get that alert and then discuss it with your friends on social media after that at least it worked in some way?
Absolutely. I think that there's an opportunity here using it as a conversation starter. One of the things that we're really concerned about, though, from the social science aspect is that we want people to take protective action right when they get the shake alert on their phone. So if you were to have to do that, say, 20 or 30 times, say, in a week, you would sort of train yourself to know, well, maybe I don't need to take protective action. So we want to make sure that we don't over-alert people. So we're concerned because those seconds in between when you get the alert and when something happens are critical to safety.
Bob, if you can go back in time for a second, and just the conversations that were happening all over the place after Ridgecrest and that the Shake Alert LA app wasn't working, what were you thinking? Were you thinking, yeah, it works, but it maybe doesn't work the way you want it to work?
So we were banking on the fact that we wanted to only alert people for potentially damaging shaking. So for both earthquakes, one on July 4th and July 5th, both the Shake Alert system, the USGS side, and the delivery side, Shake Alert LA, did exactly everything the way they should. So it performed as designed.
You can tell me, Bob, were you annoyed that people weren't understanding it?
Well, it was an opportunity to better understand how to explain these things, and actually, I learn a lot from interacting with folks. So I'm really pleased, even though some of the feedback was a little bit harsh. It's okay. That's the way it goes. That's part of the job.
That's Bob DeGroot with the U.S. Geological Survey. Bob, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, switching gears, LA County is radically shifting how its criminal justice system handles people with mental illnesses. Yesterday, the County Board of Supervisors voted to scrap a longtime plan that would have turned the Men's Central Jail downtown into a mental health treatment facility. More than 200 people spoke at the meeting to urge supervisors to scrap the plan, and they erupted in applause after the vote. KPCC reporter Alyssa Jung Perry is here to tell us what this vote means and why jail reform advocates are excited about the county's new direction. Alyssa, thanks for joining us.
Hey, A, thanks for having me.
All right, so let's back up a little bit first. The supervisors voted last year to tear down the Men's Central Jail and replace it with something better equipped to handle inmates with mental illness. What was the rationale behind that original decision?
Right, so it's known that the jail is very, very old and it's in terrible condition, and pretty much everyone on every side agrees that it either needs to be remodeled or just torn down. But at the same time, an estimated 30% of inmates in the LA County jails are considered to have a severe mental illness that needs medical attention. The county jails are understaffed and not set up to handle that population, and the lawmakers recognize that. So last year, the county approved this $2 billion plan to tear down the Men's Central Jail and replace it with a mental health jail to treat those inmates. But jail reform advocates like the ACLU and Youth Justice Coalition were saying that this was still a jail, but for sick people, and locking them up wasn't going to fix the problem. They said money should be put into community-based treatment options instead.
I remember those groups were pretty loud in their opposition to the idea of a mental health jail. Is that what led the supervisors to scrap the plan this week?
In part, yes, but it's taken a pretty long journey for the soups to come to the decision that was made yesterday. Back in February of this year, the board said, okay, we hear your concerns, but we still need to do something about this rundown jail. So they voted to turn it into a mental health treatment center instead. And the jail reform advocates basically quickly said, well, that's just a different name for a mental health jail. It's still locking sick people up. In the meantime, there was a study done by the county's Office of Diversion and Reentry. It found that more than half of the county inmates who are mentally ill could be safely diverted back into the community with treatment, and that could probably help stop this cycle of inmates going from the streets to jail back to the streets. So this pressure from the activists combined with concerns from the county's own people led them to this week's decision.
Okay, now who opposes this plan to scrap the mental health treatment center? I assume there's got to be some opposition.
Yeah, Sheriff Alex Villanueva, for one, he told the board that he was for diversion, but not having a facility to accommodate the rising number of sick inmates with serious criminal records like murder would actually put the community at risk.
There can be deadly outcomes. The question is, how willing are you to balance the need for diversion, which is important, with the safety of the community?
Villanueva argued that the mental health treatment center would have struck that balance. Only one supervisor, Catherine Barger, voted against scrapping the original plan to build a mental health treatment center for inmates. But in the end, a majority of these SUPs voted to cancel it.
Seems like a pretty big deal, though, for the county to essentially side with jail reform activists. So what happens now?
Totally. It's a really monumental shift for one of the biggest county jail systems in the country. And some people call it one of the biggest mental health hospitals in the country. So to say we're committed to moving away from locking up inmates with mental illness and towards the kind of alternatives that activists have long pushed for, we're talking about things like permanent supportive housing, community-based treatment. It's the county board saying, hey, we recognize that putting these people behind bars is not working. As for what's next, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. The county plans to hire a consultant to come up with a plan to house and rehabilitate these inmates with mental illness and substance abuse in community settings. And they still need to figure out what they will do with the Mid Central Jail. It has to be upgraded. There are still people who have to be behind bars. But the big question is, what will actually replace it?
That's KPCC's Alyssa Jung-Perry talking to us about the L.A. County Board of Supervisors' decision to scrap a longtime plan that would have turned the Men's Central Jail downtown into a mental health treatment facility for inmates. Alyssa, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Abe, for having me.
It can be very difficult to follow in the footsteps of a famous and successful parent, especially if they're in the same business. There's going to be whispers that the kids wouldn't be anywhere without mom or dad. Now, this dynamic can be tougher on a daughter trying to step into the shoes of a legendary father. For example, Lakers owner Jeannie Buss being compared to her dad, Hall of Famer Jerry Buss. Coming up, another daughter is taking the reins of a huge corporation her father used to run. But in this case, dad once publicly dismissed his daughter as a lightweight. Find out why when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The CBS Viacom merger is a go. We'll tell you what it means for consumers and the streaming landscape as a whole, plus why Universal executives are receiving death threats. Let's go on the lot.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins me every Wednesday to talk all things showbiz. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, A.
All right, let's start with news about the CBS Viacom merger. Rebecca, why is this more than just a merger, more of a reunification? Give us some context on it.
I love little peaches and herb with my business news. Can I just say?
Yeah.
Well, so CBS and Viacom were once one company called simply Viacom. Sumner Redstone split them up in 2006 in a very different media landscape. And now his daughter, Sherry Redstone, has reunited them. The thinking is that in an era with competition from the internet and streaming companies, traditional media companies need to be as big as they can be to stay alive.
And Sumner Redstone hasn't been that nice to his daughter over the years. I mean, they don't have the best relationship.
I would say they definitely have a complicated relationship. There's a terrific profile of Sherry Redstone in the LA Times by Meg James, where she talks about that a little bit in her lead, how he sort of dismissed her as a lightweight who didn't contribute to the business. she certainly seems to be contributing to the business now, and she'll be the chair of this new merged company.
Yeah, she is 100% in charge. Okay, so 13 years have passed since these two split. They're back together again. What grand plans do the companies have when it comes to tackling the digital landscape?
Well, they want to sell more streaming subscriptions. They've got a CBS All Access streaming service, a Showtime streaming service. So they'll be focusing on them. They also want to sell more ads digitally. And they are going to create original programming for other streaming platforms like Netflix. For instance, Paramount, which is part of Viacom, has already got a deal with Netflix to supply films to that service.
What kind of things, though, are going to fall under the new company's umbrella, so to speak?
Well, Viacom owns Paramount, as I mentioned, also Nickelodeon, MTV. On the CBS side, you have the good old CBS broadcast channel, yeah. The book publisher, Simon & Schuster. So it's a lot.
What will this mean, Rebecca, for customers and viewers in terms of billing?
Well, the honest answer is I don't know. I mean, look, CBS is a broadcast channel that's still free.
But
for there now. There are the streaming services we mentioned. And one thing you and I have talked about on the show before is just how many streaming services are people going to be willing to pay for? Do you bundle them? Do you come up with some free model using advertising? These are all things that will be determined.
I think I mentioned before, I'm the sucker that'll buy them all, more than likely. They're relying on me and my stupidity.
Hollywood thanks you.
Yeah, there you go. Now, you know, I was thinking there's also an opportunity to build up franchises here, specifically Star Trek. How can this merger work toward that?
Well, one thing that happened both to Star Trek and to Mission Impossible when this company broke up in 2006 was that the TV rights went to CBS and the film rights went to Viacom. Now they'll all be under one roof, which makes it easier to do what Disney has done with Marvel, where you have films, shows, merchandise, all of it kind of cohering and feeding the audience's interest in the properties.
You know, mergers seem to be the thing nowadays. AT&T acquiring Time Warner, Disney closing the deal with 20th Century Fox. How does this one, Viacom-CBS, compare?
Well, it's significantly smaller. AT&T spent $80 billion on Time Warner. Disney paid $71.3 billion for Fox. This deal is what's known as a stock swap, but it values Viacom at about $11 billion.
Wow. All right. So let's move on now to something that I think for in the future, Rebecca, I want to see if we can avoid 1 week without talking about Netflix, but it seems impossible. You wrote a piece about the company's lobbying efforts worldwide, which isn't something they tend to spotlight. Why not?
Well, all Netflix ever wants to talk about is its content, its shows and movies. They don't like to sort of peel back the curtain on aspects of their business, and this is no exception. They like to sort of quietly get their work done when it comes to affecting policy in the U.S. and around the world.
So Netflix has 30 full-time staffers, and they're devoted to public policy. But unlike other media companies, its focus isn't domestic, it's worldwide. Why worldwide? Why the international focus for Netflix?
Well, they definitely lobby in the U.S., but internationally is where their growth is coming from. And particularly in Europe, it's where Netflix faces the harshest regulatory environment. There's a new EU law going to effect in 2020 that mandates at least 30% of the content from these streaming companies has to be of European origin. So they have to meet that requirement. They also don't want a tax on streaming companies, which is something that's been proposed there. So they've got reason to be particularly engaged in that part of the world.
And Netflix is moving to align itself more as a studio, right? Instead of a Silicon Valley kind of company?
Yeah, earlier this year, they joined the Motion Picture Association of America, which is the group that lobbies on behalf of the movie studios. They left the lobbying group that represents the tech companies like Facebook and Google. And in a way, this move makes sense because Netflix itself has evolved. It really is a fully fledged studio now, and it has more in common with those companies.
Luckily, I still think I can merge them both. So in other words, I'm old enough where I remember them as a digital company and still relatively young enough to know them as a studio. So they're both to me.
Those little red envelopes will be a collector's item
at some point that
DVDs used to come in, yeah.
I do remember that. All right, let's scale things back now and talk about Universal's call to scrap this movie.
Every year, a bunch of elites kidnap normal folk like us. Where'd they get you from?
Wyoming.
Mississippi.
Orlando. And hunt us for sport.
That is from a now obsolete film called The Hunt. Rebecca, tell us what the premise of this film was or is.
Right. Well, the film still exists and may get released in other countries, but it's not looking likely here in the U.S. It's a satire about a group of people hunting other people. The political angle to the film is that the people doing the hunting are sort of liberal elites, and they call the people they're hunting deplorables.
Now, what has been the response since that trailer was released? Because its timing was pretty unfortunate.
Yeah, the ads began running right around the time of the Dayton and El Paso mass shootings, both of which had what appeared to be politically extremist motives. And that made what was pitched as a satire too close to reality for many people. When The Hollywood Reporter initially covered this, some of the Universal executives and filmmakers started receiving death threats via email and on social media, and they paused the campaign.
And on top of that, the film became a target of President Trump's Twitter attacks. He accused the film of being made, quote, in order to inflame and cause chaos, end quote there. Here's the thing, Rebecca, political satire. I mean, it's that's what it is, I think. And it's also a hot button issue. Couldn't the studio have seen more of this coming their way?
Yeah, I mean, definitely this film was considered too hot to touch by some other folks who looked at it, potential distributors. The producers, Jason Blum and Damon Lindelof, are very prolific, well-respected, do a lot of business with the studios. So I think that was part of what pushed it through, despite what were some clear misgivings on behalf of some of the people aware of the premise in the film.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, Yogi Berra, Hall of Fame catcher for the Yankees in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. One of the greatest players of all time, won 10 World Series. He was also the master of the malaprop. His most famous example, it ain't over till it's over. Coming up, why this other Yogiism, this other Yogi Berra phrase, no one goes there nowadays, it's too crowded, why that could be applied now to Disneyland. Find out why when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Poor unfortunate souls in pain, in need.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. And count the people of Disneyland among those poor souls lately. It's had declining attendance this summer at its theme parks. It was down 3% in the last quarter, which is surprising considering all the hype around its biggest attraction in years, Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, which opened in May. Are ticket prices to blame? Well, for more, we have Robert Niles. He runs the website themeparkinsider.com. He joins us now. Robert, welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, Robert, last time you were on the show, it was just before Galaxy's Edge was set to open, and the word was that crowds this summer were going to be intense, but that has not been the case. Is it really because of ticket prices?
Yeah, I think that's a large part of it. I mean, there was definitely some Disney magic at play here. They wanted the crowds to thin out a little bit, make some people disappear, but they did too good of a job. And as a result, I think the crowds were a lot lower than they expected. They came back with some discounts later in the summer, and the crowd levels have rebounded somewhat. It's not quite the ghost town that a lot of people were portraying it as back in May, but definitely Disney wasn't getting the huge crowd that they were initially expecting when Galaxy's Edge opened.
What are the ticket prices right now?
Well, I mean, the cheapest you can possibly get into a Disney theme park for one day right now is over $100. So they've broken that barrier and gone well past it. But ticket prices are a lot like, it's like asking someone what's the price of an airplane flight at this point. It's gotten so complicated with daily prices and all of the different type of levels and passes you can get. They're really trying to use pricing to even out the crowd levels over the course of the year. But for the most part, you're looking at, you know, $100 a day plus for a day at Disneyland.
And if you want that park hopper, you're looking over $200 at that point, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But to be fair, though, most people who are visiting on annual passes.
Oh, yeah.
And if you go a lot, you can get the per-day price down pretty cheap on that. And the annual pass strategy was also part of the reason why the attendance has been down. They really increased the number of blockout days where annual pass holders couldn't visit during the summer because they expected the crowd to be so large because of Galaxy's Edge.
You know, there was a pretty heated discussion amongst our staff today about Disneyland's annual passes and whether they're even worth getting anymore because of the pricing and the blackout dates. One of our staff members said, I'm not going to pay for it anymore. So what's going on with that?
Disney is actually trying to fundamentally change their annual pass program. And I think the pushback that they've gotten from a lot of their loyal fans is driving this. A few months ago, they introduced a new pass called the Disney Flex Pass. And that one doesn't have a whole bunch of blockout dates on it like you see with the SoCal Select or the Deluxe Pass, but you do have to make a reservation in advance to visit. with the exception of a few days during the school year, you just can't roll up and take out your pass and get into the park. You have to go online in advance and make a reservation to come that day. But if you play the system right, and the way a lot of people are learning how to do it, you can get in for the same number of days that some people are paying twice the amount for with more traditional annual passes.
Robert, how rare is it for Disneyland to experience a decline in attendance like this? It just seems like it's an automatic, that it's always going to be crowded all the time. So I think it's a shock for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people very much were surprised, because when we've seen downturns in Disney attendance in the past, it's almost always correlated with some big economic downturn, the Great Recession or, you know, the travel recession after 9/11, times when it wasn't just Disneyland, but everyone across the board was experiencing a decline in attendance. This time, though, I mean, Universal's been crowded this summer. Knott's has been crowded this summer. I think a lot of the people who might have gone to Disneyland went to those other parks. So this is much more Disney-specific than an indication of weakness in the economy like we've seen in the past.
You know, Robert, Bloomberg reported that Star Wars just isn't as exciting to younger people as it's been for maybe someone my age or maybe your age, Robert, depending on how old you are when the original movie came out a while ago. Do you think that's true?
I mean, with any entertainment franchise, you're ultimately only as good as your last movie or your last TV show. So if the upcoming movie is a really big hit, I think they'll do a really good job of cultivating more of a relationship with younger fans. But you're right, they just don't have the same history with it that a bunch of Gen Xers do, who remember going to see the original trilogy in the theaters and had all of those action figures and played Star Wars nonstop like I did when I was a kid. I mean, Disney can come up with a whole bunch of dog Star Wars movies and we're still going to love the franchise. But for young people who have Harry Potter and Marvel and all these other franchises competing for their attention, you know, if Star Wars doesn't deliver a series of hits, you know, they're going to turn elsewhere.
One more thing, Robert, you're the theme park insider in the room. Is now a good time to go to Disneyland?
Oh, yeah, I still think it's a good time, even with the attendance coming up a little bit in the last few weeks. As people are getting back to school, this tends to be a pretty good time to visit anyway. And the big new attraction in Galaxy's Edge, Star Wars Rise of the Resistance, is going to be opening in January. So a lot of the people who might not have come because that ride wasn't open yet, they may be turning up after the new year. So you might want to slip that visit in right now.
Robert Niles runs a website, themeparkinsider.com. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We love two things here on Take Two: good food and classic LA architecture. And if you're anything like us, then your little Angelino heart just might leap every time you pass a spot like Dinah's Family Restaurant in Westchester. Over the past 60 years, Dinah's become a bit of a local legend, serving up its classic apple pancake. The California Report's Sasha Coca recently revisited the diner of her childhood and brings us this.
I grew up in L.A., just a mile from LAX, and I'm going to take you to one of my family's favorite neighborhood spots.
Hi, good morning. Welcome to Dinah's. How you doing?
We've been eating their one-of-a-kind apple pancakes for more than four decades.
Table for seven, please.
It's called Dinah's, and it's a diner that opened in 1959 with Googie-style architecture. Think the Jetsons, big red and blue stucco orbs jutting from the ceiling, rock walls, and vinyl booths.
We have to get the apple pancake, though. I mean, we have to, for nostalgia's sake.
Oh, I know, but sometimes I feel like mixing it up. That there's so many options, you know? Pancakes, waffles, chicken. So the menu is endless.
That's my little brother, Akash. We've been fighting over what to order here since we were kids.
Or a bacon and cheese waffle. What is a bacon and cheese waffle?
But in the end, I win out.
Could we order an apple pancake, actually?
Yes, small, large.
I think we should get a large for the whole table. Large.
Takes 20 minutes, but it's worth it. Can't find it anywhere else. It makes your day better.
It's hard for my kids to be patient while we're waiting for the apple pancake.
Apple pancake, apple pancake, apple pancake, la la la.
Like a giant apple pie for breakfast? Yeah.
Yumminess.
While we're waiting, I chat with Terry Ernst. She started here as a waitress in 1972. Eventually, she married the son of the owner, and she and her husband now run the place. I ask her where Dinah's got its name. She says her in-laws were looking for something that sounded Southern.
So no one in the family is named Dinah. So, but you know the song, Someone's in the Kitchen with Dinah?
Someone's in the kitchen with Dinah. Someone's in the kitchen, I know. Someone's in the kitchen with Dinah, strumming on the old banjo.
I mean, we have food here, a lot of the traditional plates that nobody makes anymore. Meatloaf, imagine that. Who makes liver and onions nowadays? Fried chicken gizzards.
That's Carla Maraveles. She's worked at Dinah's 20 years, and she says everything here is made from scratch. The gravies, mashed potatoes, biscuits.
This is definitely a place where time has stood still. When people come in here, I greet them. I make sure that they're seated where they want to, especially our old schoolers. We already know where they want to sit.
People like Ellis Smith, who always likes a big booth near the front.
We come here probably 3-4 times a week. My wife and I usually come to breakfast, and my uncle and I, we come to breakfast, and we also come to dinner on Thursday evenings, every Thursday.
Is there a particular special or something on Thursdays?
Chicken. All you can eat chicken.
The fried chicken is actually what draws many regulars to Dinah's. It's breaded the day before, fried, and pressure cooked in a special machine. In fact, Dinah's has a big chicken bucket up on a pole outside its takeout department. The owners say the guy who pioneered the design went on to bring the idea to KFC. Dinah's 50s decor has been used as a backdrop for Hollywood, too. Shows like Modern Family and Malcolm in the Middle. And its signature red and white chicken bucket was featured in the film Little Miss Sunshine.
Chicken, holy God almighty. Is it possible just once
Dad?
We could get something to eat for dinner around here that's not the damn chicken?
Hey, Dad.
I'm just saying.
Dad.
But for me, it's really about the apple pancake. After a 20-minute wait, it's finally here.
Then you have to put the big scoop of butter on top of the apple pancake so it basically rolls all over it like a snowball and melts the butter all over the crispy apples and brown sugar.
Who else wants an apple pancake?
Just as I'm biting into the layers of apple and cinnamon, I get invited back into the kitchen to see how these pancakes are made. A tall man in a tall chef's hat is pouring pounds of peeled and sliced apples into a skillet of sizzling butter. Salome Jimenez, everybody calls him Uncle Salome, is 73. He's from Jalisco, Mexico, and he's worked here 47 years. He comes out of retirement on the weekends to whip up the apple pancakes for the crowd because he's faster than anybody else. He tells me this is the only place in California that makes these pancakes. Every one the size of a pie, baked individually in a cast iron skillet. Dinah's makes 400 to 500 of these every month. I watch as Salome pours a flour and egg mixture over the apples, then sprinkles huge scoops of cinnamon and sugar over the top.
Wow.
He slides it in the oven to bake for 10 to 15 minutes. When it comes out, he'll flip over the pancake in the skillet so the apples sit on top of the dough.
Gracias, gracias. También le voy a decir tío, Salome, gracias.
I am ecstatic. I am watching the apple pancake master reveal the secrets of my childhood comfort food. This summer, Dinah's marked its 60th anniversary with a Blast from the Past event, where they lowered all their prices to match the menu from 1959. No apple pancakes, but you could get a breakfast special, bacon or sausage, eggs, and two regular pancakes for $1.25.
Dinah didn't make no pudding, didn't make the apple pie.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two, well, that's a problem. But it is an easy fix. That problem can be resolved right away. All you got to do is go wherever you get your podcast and look for us, Take Two, and there it is, all waiting for you. We're also on social media, at Take Two. That's at Take Two. That's on Twitter. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.
I hear you noodling.